Welcome to the BFM Historical Society. This week, we talk to Jude Anaru, former station manager. She tells us about the convoluted and difficult process of securing BFM a permanent broadcasting license. Well, hello and welcome to the BFM Historical Society, Jude Anaru.
Kia ora, Patrick, how are you?
Very good, nice to have you here. Thank you. To start off with, for the record, I'd like you to tell us what years you were at BFM and in what capacity that was.
Let's see, 1984 to 1989, 1 year working in the news department, a year as the media officer on AUSA University, and then station managing from the end of 85 through to the end of 89 when I left.
So you were a newsreader to begin with?
I were.
In 84.
I used to be.
So tell me, how did you get into that?
Well, the thing is, I was living out in Mangere, all the way out there, and I came to university in order to get a degree, which I laugh about now. And I had lectures at the beginning of the day, lectures at the end of the day. So I looked to find somewhere where I had a base where I could spend some time between stuff instead of actually catching a bus all the way back to Mangere. And when you signed up and enrolled at university at that stage, the AUSA had these little cards that you'd rip off your form. And one of them was for Radio B. And I filled in one of those, said that I want to be involved in something and put down news. And so I bowled up and almost from that very moment, I was out hunting for news, and probably a week later, I was reading it.
Were you interested in doing a music show at the time, or were you quite happy to just do the news?
Well, at that stage, you know, B wasn't going 24 hours. And so what I used to do, along with Fiona McDonald, is that we used to get to practice from midnight to dawn. And so we would make mix tapes on cassette at night, practicing mixing from one turntable to the next.
Yeah.
And we did that until we got really good, and then spoke to the PD at the time and said, oh, we're good enough to go on the radio now, please. And they went, yes, but I think what they meant was actually we don't have anybody to fill these really shit times of day, so why don't you do that? And we were like, oh, we're so excited, so wide-eyed, let's do it.
So from then, you said you were working for AUSA.
Yeah, what happened was there was a time there when B's funding was in peril. And so Debbie Gibbs, who was station manager at the time, sort of looked at me and went, I want you to stand for the position of media officer and executive, because she thought that somebody who was pro B would be great to have a representative on there to ensure that the funding was safe so the station could continue. Actually, I had to campaign. I had to turn up at lecture theatres and do speeches.
You have to be voted in.
Yeah, I had posters. Jonathan Ganley made posters for me. It was incredible. I really kind of, I don't think I was really present in that whole process. And then all of a sudden it was like, Jude Anaru, media officer. And I'm like, whoa, okay.
You got the votes and then that was it, a job.
Yep.
Were you paid?
No, I wasn't paid. No, it wasn't. In fact, I think the whole time I was here, I only received a payment for station manager in perhaps the last 2 years, and it was the grand total of something like $3,200 per annum. And so I had a couple of part-time jobs, including a cleaning job and a bar job at the same time.
Oh, wow. Sort of, did you get in any trouble with the other exec members as a sort of perceived conflict of interest?
Absolutely not. I think, you know, the interesting thing is, Patrick, it's kind of weird, okay, and it sort of followed me around quite a lot, is the fact that I am a Māori and a woman, there has been some sort of distance about dissing me, or not necessarily, you know, I get challenged, but I don't get handled badly in some ways, because people go, oh, she's a Māori. The fact that I'm half Jewish, well, you know. Yeah, so that was, in fact, they didn't really necessarily perceive a conflict of interest, but they looked to the fact that there was somebody there who could see the issues in the context of the whole AUSA and still push for things for B in a positive way. Because at that stage, I was also running, I was like the media officer ran Crackham.
Yeah, the magazine, that's right.
Yeah. We didn't have, we were about to lose our money, and we managed to get the votes and keep the money, which I think was something like, it was between $3 and $6 per student, which kept on being contributed to run the station.
So I take it you did that job for a year?
I think I did do it for 12 months, and then I fully stepped up as station manager.
And what was the, you know, that sort of transition, what prompted that?
It was what was really crazy about the culture of B at the time was that you felt like you could do anything. You really did. And I didn't necessarily know at times that I was taking on projects that were huge. I just kind of did stuff. I don't know what it was. I just did stuff. You know, the reciting of the transmitter as the passion for coverage. You just wanted everybody to hear what we were doing.
You want to reach more people.
Yeah. Sure. I think it was pretty much assumed that I was going to take over because I think it went Debbie Gibbs, Andrew Bishop, then me. Crafty Maori ways. This track is by Fetus Productions and it's called What's Going On. And I remember playing this particular track, the very first broadcast that we had when we went from AM to FM. We did an OB down in the quad. And it was 6 a.m. or earlier, and I just remember the feeling of hitting this. It was on, I think we'd put it to cart, hitting the cart, and hearing this actually going through really loud speakers in the quad and going, hell, we're FM, and we're on air, and it was this track.
Change your life anytime. You can change your mind. So fine. You can feel your soul anyway. You can feel your heart breathe every day. Only got one day.
disappear. What's going on? What's going on?
So Jude, that was the first song you got to play when BFM went into FM.
Yeah, 91.8. May have been beginning of 86. Well, I'm not absolutely sure. I don't know what I was doing yesterday.
23 years ago.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Did the call sign of the station change then? Like you said, because it was 91.8 was the frequency. And
Stereo 918.
Yeah, that's right. And prior to that it was
Radio B...
1404. That's it.
Yeah.
So kind of a big moment.
Do you know what BFM stands for?
Well, it was Radio Bosom originally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It stands for bloody fucking marvellous. It's
That's appropriate.
Yeah.
So tell me, once you became station manager, taking over from Andrew Bishop.
Mm-hmm.
I guess big things were afoot, and what was sort of kind of some of the issues for you back then? You know, what did you want to sort of tackle?
It was there was a sort of a twofold thing, and it was all the thing about having being able to work in an environment like this and realise the magic of the fact that you've got media that you're working with is that people are really, really driven. And the two prong thing that we were looking for was not only again revisiting expansion of the audience, so reciting the transmitter until we got more and more power, but we were also looking to have longevity of broadcasting. So we were formally on the 28-day back to back warrants, short term broadcasting applications, which we had to apply for every. We could apply for them in a bunch, so you could go for like 6 months of 28 days back to back. And that sort of thing. And then we were looking at wanting to broadcast full time. And that was sort of in part and parcel of the relationship between reciting the transmitter, increasing the power outage, meant you needed some more money. So we're looking at broadcasting longer and having a real drive at bringing in more advertising.
And was the ministry open to that idea? I mean, I take it you had to kind of lobby them quite hard in order to grant a different type of a license from the temporary license that you had.
Yeah, there was kind of pressures coming internally from the university and externally from external radio. Some of that was at the time because there was not a lot of local music being played on radio at all, and B was the king queen of that at the time, and so there was a hell of a lot of good PR behind us and good press from all sorts of critics and people. The next track we're going to play is from a band called The Feelies. It's a song called It's Only Life. And I used to play this to me because there was a particular person that I was working with named Paul Cassidy who he knew how to mess with me, I guess. And then one day I came into work and he had taken a photocopy, he'd taken many photocopies of my head and put it on the body of Robocop and called it Robo Jude. Had written something about it, and he had hidden it inside the cover of, like, just, you know, I don't know, 100 records in the record collection, and he'd blown them up to different sizes and stuck them all around the station. And in fact, just before I came in, because we had a typewriter then as opposed to a computer, and he'd hit the two enter bars on the computer and he'd put my image, like, stuck it to the keyboard, and I came in and there was this little robo dude going left, right, back and forward, back and forward, back and forward. And this song, It's Only Life, used to remind me to just be very calm, very calm. We were perceived as maybe being some sort of threat to revenue if we were to make the transition to broadcast full time. I mean, essentially it was a challenge. We had to not only lobby the tribunal, but we also had to lobby and try and work alongside existing broadcasters. And there was actually a time in 1986, and we had our transmitter on the Sheraton Hotel. They wanted us off, and we had nowhere to go. But Radio Pacific came in, and Radio Pacific let us do an interview and a plea on air. And it was through that we managed to find the museum as a potential place to site our transmitter.
So was this the Radio Broadcasters Association, the RBA, that were having kind of issues?
It wasn't necessarily them, because they as an organisation, once you've got all those, and I say white men in the room, they have a confidence and strength and arrogance that, you know, once you get them in a bunch, they're quite a confident, and you're just a little gnat, and you don't really matter. But as you start to work one-on-one with the members, they weren't called the Breeze at the time, but there was a kind of fairly youth orientated station that were looking for to dominate market share, and they sort of saw the Bears as I don't know, just being able to take away some of the audience and therefore some of the revenue
for
yeah
sure.
Yeah, so we were, there was a bunch of us pretty involved in talking to these people, and in the end they helped us and provided us with resources to put our case together for the tribunal They're actually really helpful.
Wow. That is cool. So you've pretty much got them on side.
We did. I did all sorts of things, though, in order to get it. Okay, a little bit of background to that is that I was foolishly studying management studies. It was ridiculous, but anyway, I was doing management studies, and I had at that stage, maybe I'd been at B since, say, 84, and I'd been managing for a couple of years. I had a huge sense of frustration because we had about, I think, 80 to 100 volunteers who were working around the station, and we had a pool of money that wasn't enough to go around, and within the volunteers we were still trying to run a service that handled advertising and promotions and production and everything. And I was getting really kind of run down with problem solving. I found solving problems really, really difficult. And so I went to the management studies department because I thought that our organisation B at the time looked pretty similar to Greenpeace in terms of its structure of volunteers, contributions and still
running. Right.
And so I talked to Professor Kerr Inkson and a woman named Kelly, whose surname I can't remember, and asked them to do a study essentially into B. And that was motivated not only because I was having problem solving, but that there was still that kind of vast determination and belief in what we were doing, and we wanted more and more and more of it.
You wanted to do it better.
We wanted to equip people, wanted to resource people, wanted to be able to be the best that we could be. They actually really did help. I remember having several meetings with them, bringing them across to talk to an announcers meeting. They did independent studies with various members of staff and talked to them, and then they published a report based on being a voluntary, like a mainly voluntary organisation, as we talked about, with a core group of people employed, and then helped me to make a transition to form a new governance structure, if you like, in order to meet the tribunal's criteria to be a full-time operating radio station. I mean, if there is a comparison, I could... I've been working on lots of Māori television lately, but when Māori get their claims and settlements, they have to go through a legislative process to form some sort of body to administer. And we couldn't afford a lawyer. We had a former AUSA president, David Kirkpatrick, working to us, consulting to us, but had to borrow some clothes to stand up at the tribunal and represent us. And that was, that was really something. It was frightening and marvellous.
Did you have to go to Wellington?
No, they had their hearing
up here.
Yeah, in the district court, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, and frightening it was. It was frightening. But again, I've been working with Robert Southon to prepare this proposal, and we worked really hard, and we prepared this massive dossier of information, helped by the station manager from the Breeze or whatever it was, and Trevor Edgerton of some sort of conglomeration of a successful FM service, and they helped us do, because we had to do future projections of revenue for 10 years.
Yeah.
But they were able to give us computer programs, feed the information and help us spit it out. So in the end, they were able to, really help us go about our stuff.
Okay.
Tribunal published their report too. They made a point of saying that they knew that the service was unique, and saying sort of, good on you fellas for hanging in there, really. But the other thing that we perceived as part of the brand, really, was that it was really important to keep the on-air management structure, promotions and everything, the core group of people here, continuing to match the turnover of students at the time, so that B could continue to move forward and innovate continue to renew itself and reflect, actually. That's what it was. It's about keeping yourself renewed and in tune with the audience. Mm. And the trust was set up at that point to kind of take the pressure off off the core staff, allow this whole renewal and fabulousness continue to happen.
We covered the change to FM, and we also covered the license to broadcast permanently. full time.
Yes.
It's a special license. So what was next?
Oh, somewhere in between that was Summer Access BFM.
Ah, because it used to shut down during the holiday break.
Yeah, yeah. So the way that we got around that was that we hooked up with Access Radio Auckland, and I think they didn't have a frequency to broadcast. We had a frequency and a station, and also we did this thing called Summer Access BFM to allow ourselves to broadcast over summer. And I think we had the breakfast show, and then we broke out for Access programs, which were sort of community groups representing themselves on radio. And then I think we came back for the evening show, or maybe for a drive show, and on from there. And we did that for a period of summer. There was, you know, the perception that we were outlaws, and they weren't. And so the melding or the combination of those two services was even though we both needed each other, the actual reality of it was frightening to both, I think.
Mm, well, unusual.
Yeah, yeah. Unusual. But in the end, we worked together pretty well. They talked about the sort of groups that would be coming on and the sort of things they could do. And it was a pretty unusual broadcast. But we made it through summer. And I think I did, I may even still have the cassette of doing the first Christmas Day.
Wow.
The intent, like B's intent if you strip it back, and Access's intent if you strip it back, they worked pretty well together.
Mm,
yeah. It's just made unusual radio.
Yeah. So you mentioned before about the transmitter moving to Waiatarua. Whenabouts did that?
I think if I look at, I found this stuff on the internet the other day, I think it was 1989 that we first started broadcasting at fuller power. There was one on the Sheraton, and then it went to the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the museum, because we were only allowed to be on the museum for 12 months.
Oh,
then we went up to Mangawhau, to Mount Eden. They were dead against it, but again, that we went to that was really good. We went to a city council meeting or a borough council meeting, and borrow clothes again and go in. But this time I had great support. Like the B people all came behind and sat on the those beach, what are they called,
bleachers, yep.
Kind of thing. And we represented ourselves at the council meeting and were persuasive. And they allowed us. They allowed us to do that. And I used to, because I don't drive, but I used to walk up to Mangawhau and just look at the transmitter because I go, well, yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So we've had actually a lot of generous people along the way allowing us to do things. Because I remember, like, when I first started at B, there were still stories of people who had to run down to the transmitter when it was located in the AM transmitter, when it's located on Shore Road in Remuera, and shoo the cows away because the cows were interfering with the transmission. And so, it's our stories.
That's hilarious.
Gone a long way, man. We were actually finding, because we had to find another, an additional $60,000, I think, in order to, as well as operating costs and every other cost associated with the station. So it was, again, finding, expanding, believing, doing, you know, good creative shit on the radio, and just building up confidence in ourselves as being able to provide a service that people wanted to buy into. Well, then we had to go back and, you know, address a plan about, you know, being able to further exploit our resources and our shows, because, you know, as always, the specialist shows have always been outstanding. Shows have always been, you know, pretty outstanding, unique, innovative, you know, all of that sort of thing. And so it was a case of actually being able to figure out what that meant and how to sell it.
How to sell it. Yeah.
Yeah, creating a brand and figuring out how to sell it and attracting. I mean, it was easy at first to look at those relationships between the banks and the banks, students.
Mm.
BFM, and so finding sponsorship for all the specialist shows as well, and doing, as B's always done, external promotions. I've worked on the door of a huge amount of gigs. at one stage the army wanted to sponsor something, and I'm like, you know, at that stage I was pretty much like, yeah, well, come on, we're looking for $60,000, you know, let's take their money, let's take their money. But there were some pretty debate's not the right word, but there were some discussions, and I think at that stage we may have run the army ads maybe for maybe 3 days, and then we had to say no thank you, we won't take that particular contract, which was annoying. This track is one from the Able Tasmans, and it's one that helps me to remember Graham doing Breakfast on B. He was a mighty fine, smart and funny and informed person, and I like this because it reminds me of him.
What was that thing you said? Run that one by me again. What was that thing you saw? Left it running at my door. One more time, yes, one more time, I should have said. One more time, yes, one more time, I should have said. Got your photographs, six of them hanging on my wall. What was that thing you said, designed to make me feel small? One more time, yes, one more time, I should have said. One more time, yes, one more time, I should have said.
That was a great bit of reminiscing, that track.
Yeah, it was actually, because as you reminded me, it was a classic. It was, we used to have C Rotate, which was local music only, and I think that then tracks would move from C to A, which was High Rotate A playlist, and I think that was one of the first local tracks that managed to make that transition.
Get onto A.
Then of course when you were given your rundown to play, every now and then you would try and defy the program director and just maybe slip in the one that you wanted to play.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, it's the Able Tasmans. Excuse me.
How did that happen?
Yeah. I do remember firing Greg Johnson.
Can you tell me that story? Are you allowed to tell me? Do you want to share that story?
Well, let's see. We had for some reason we like to have these assistant station managers, these ASMs. And it was a position that, it was just a position to try at that stage to keep grooming people to move through, know the business and all that sort of thing. And Greg was an ASM. And I don't know if I can tell the story.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
The next track is The Great Unwashed, who came out of The Clean. And it's a track called Born in the Wrong Time. And it's a kind of a tribute to, for me, it's a song, it's a tribute to the live music scene and the local music scene that we had the absolute benefit of, in terms of not only organising the live gigs, but also playing on our rotate, as is a great song.
If you see him, will you tell him that I've been looking for him? And if I tell you, will you promise not to share with anybody else?
This is a track from New Order. It's called Ceremony, and my choice for this track is because the first time I ever came up to B, I was still at school. I was at high school, and I was here for a Latin speech competition. One of my classmates was in the Latin speech competition, and I had sewn myself a pair of tartan trousers and wore this secondhand jersey and a white shirt and a tie. I don't know why I remember this, but I did. And I went, right, while everybody else is at the Latin speech competition, I'm going to go up to B. And so I kind of ran up here and knocked on some sort of door and came in, and this song was playing, Ceremony by New Order.
Thank you.
So I guess we're getting near to the end of your tenure as station manager.
Yes.
I imagine by now you would have graduated with your degree.
Oh no, I was under exclusion. I was under exclusion because we as associate members of the IBA, I used to attend conferences and represent National Student Radio, not just BFM, but all the, mm-hmm. the conglomeration of all the student radio stations. And one year their conference was in Rarotonga, and so I went to Rarotonga and came back without taking into account the time difference between Rarotonga and Auckland, and I missed my exam.
Oh.
I had actually taken all my books with me and studied.
While you were over. Oh.
And I got back here and missed my exam.
DNS did not sit.
Yeah, and so that was, once I'd missed one, it was easy. Missed others and now I am under exclusion.
Wow. At some point, I guess you would have seen an end to it and you would have thought, well, I don't want to be here anymore. Or was it that other things came up?
It was a realisation that I perhaps, after the period of time that I've been here, could be out of tune, you know, slightly out of tune or out of step with what was going on with the station. And from a position of leadership, I thought that, you know, there needed to be new leadership in there to keep driving things forward. So as much as I was, like, tired, like really, really tired, it was a conscious decision to, because, you know, we'd created this structure, I'd managed to get more rooms. Only thing I didn't manage to do was get a bathroom up here. But got the rooms and things, and I sort of felt like, yeah, it was now time to have somebody who had more vision for more things.
Hmm.
And I applied for and got recruited through an affirmative action course to employ more Māori into television.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, so I got into that.
And so that you went to TVNZ?
I did it. The course was called the Kimihia course, and there were, I think, 30 Māori all stuck in at TVNZ doing different things, and my particular position was public relations.
They'd be all big people in broadcasting now, I imagine, those people that
well,
started
yeah.
on that.
Yeah, the few there's a few Māori who have survived and are doing really well. Yeah, yeah. So at that stage, good on you, Māori Affairs. Yeah, ka pai. But I became a production attachee to the entertainment department, and under Katerina De Nave, I got to, you know, carry scripts for It's in the Bag, and I got to be a trainee runner field director on Miss New Zealand, and and all sorts of projects like that, which you got to sit in on. And there was actually formal training involved. Like, we got sent to Christchurch to do courses, and we got to Dunedin to do courses and different things and get to know the different outposts of TVNZ at the time. And when I came out of that, I ended up working, I think, on the music programs, the RTRs.
Ready to Roll.
Yeah, yep. And then did a version of Radio with Pick Jaws that had no host. It was just a late night music compilation program, music mm-hmm. videos, which I really liked.
Yeah.
I really liked doing that. From there, TV3 I went to, I think. Yes, then I went to 3, did a program called Living Earth with Mark Everton.
Mm.
Mark Everton, former B person, and Mark chose the titles music for the program I was working on called Living Earth, and it was The Bats, and it was a track called Mastery, because he Mark strongly believed that all the lessons of life could be learned in the garden, and the track was The Mastery that brings me here, and so that worked perfectly. And then in evolutions actually of Living Earth, I commissioned at one stage Mark Tiernan to create some titles music for that. I think I went in the first series of that, I was a production manager, which is a money sort of person, and then I moved on to associate producer, and then I ended up producing that particular series. So I went from that and then to one of my favourites, which was a program called Ice TV on DB3, and that was in the days when, and I've only really had two opportunities like this where you're actually given a blank page and they say, we want a program like this, here is some money,
here's the budget, you make it up.
Yeah, you make it up. And that sort of thing is, again, I have to say it's terrifying as well as it's exciting. But I always talk about my days at B as being the best days of my life. And the only time that I've come close to that is on both the Ice TV project and the Flipside project, which I did for TVNZ, because they were both, blank pages and then required people's commitment to make it happen.
And I think with Ice TV, you were able to involve a few BFM people, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. Do you know Matthew Heiner?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Who else? There were people coming in and out all the time. And I did a doco series, a doco one-off documentary in between Living Earth and Ice TV, which I commissioned Paul Cassidy to write. A series of characters that were sort of puppets, and got Dominique in to be one of the voices of the puppets, and I think I brought in another couple of B people as well with their voices, because you couldn't move away from that sort of talent, really.
And so you've looked after your friends too, commissioning Mark Tierney to do music for something and Paul to do music for something.
The fact is that the people who are so driven and to do things here are usually hugely creative, intelligent people, eh? We used to record Michael Laurie from the Headless Chickens recorded one of the Headless Chickens EPs in the recording studio here using the hi-fi tracks on a
VHS.
Yeah. And the drums were in the stairwell because of the, the
reverb. Yeah.
Yeah. And we would record here. We would go out and do OBs and record in the crater of Mount Eden on Equinox Day when it was Phil Dadson organising
from scratch
and drummers in the crater, because I have to actually do a big sort of compliment for Richard Huntington,
absolutely.
Who he once showed me a photograph of himself aged about 8 when he'd built a radio station in his bedroom.
Yes. And he would broadcast to other rooms of the house, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
This next song's going out for Mum in the kitchen. Bless him.
But he would facilitate, along with Dave Reed, they would both facilitate these amazing, broadcasts from all over the place. That was the sort of, I can't hold back on the can-do talent.
That Rick is still with us.
I didn't know that.
I honestly don't know what would happen to BFM if Rick ever left, because he's the only guy who knows how everything works.
Yeah.
He built pretty much everything that's here.
Yeah.
And if he didn't work here anymore and stuff broke down, no one could fix it.
Exactly.
He's like the mad scientist who put it all together.
He totally is. And he took the old desk, the old AM desk, out when we moved in all the new equipment and helped to install it as a radio production base at the Auckland Museum of Transport and Technology. He built them in something down there. But, you just go, oh, Rick, we've got an OB. and it's on a hill behind the valley. It's not line of sight. And it's got 14 drummers and 96 this, that and the other. And you go, oh, yeah, okay, let me just think about that.
We'll sort it out. Tell me, after Ice TV, what was your next thing?
After Ice TV. Oh, I got the arse, actually. I got booted out. And it's not the first time. and I went back to TVNZ. Kindly, a woman named Irene Gardner helped me out. And I worked for a little while on a project, which was a live daily program hosted by Susan Wood. It was kind of a chat talk format, and I was lucky to meet some good people there. From that, I executive produced a series of half-hour documentaries, which were made by the independent Māori industry. Then Flipside came along, and that was a really interesting project, that one, because I'd always wanted to at some stage, I think when I was working at Three, I'd wanted to. Oh yeah, it was when TV4 came along. I'd wanted to get Hugh doing kind of a news break type thing on TV4. I mean, I had no power to actually invoke that to happen, but it had always been in my brain that that someone, you know, like a really innovative news format could happen. So when this opportunity came up, I kind of realized that you could again take two different forms of technology and merge them in a new way, and you get interesting results. And that was by actually taking the internet and its ability to provide participation and television.
Put it on television.
Yeah. So what we did was that we ran a parallel screen situation, which was, you know, essentially we had the program on the internet and the program on TV, and then after the program finished on air, we continued it on the internet. I started up at a little company where I still am today. It's a little production company in Grey Lynn called Front of the Box Productions. It is mainly provides programs for broadcast of Māori content, and it's not that they don't only play on Māori television, they also play on TV1 and TV2. One of the series I did was called The World According to Willie and JT. That's Willie Jackson and John Tamihere. Interesting, fun. A series I'm currently working on is hosted by somebody you might know. His name is Michael Roberts, also known as Mr. Havoc.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yeah. So, and I've done a series called Takatāpui for Māori television, which is the Takatāpui is the word that Māori used to encapsulate gay, lesbian, transgender, different other forms of sexuality. And that was a really great series too.
In closing, this year BFM celebrating its 40th anniversary, which is an amazing thing.
Okay.
You've listened to the station obviously on and off over the years. I'd just like your thoughts on how you've seen BFM progress and change over the years, and also what you feel about BFM's future and what it's going to need to survive. And thrive.
Thrive. To me, thriving is an end result of having people who are happily and well and are happy in their work. And that's across the board for, you know, anywhere you work. I think that the branding exercise of 95 and that associated is really great. And a strong brand has really been needed, and I think that's worked effectively. I still enjoy the music. I still enjoy the people. It's a bit like just the sense and the purpose of renewal. I think it is going to be an important thing about keeping things moving forward.
New people all the time.
New people, but also, you know, a balance of new people and people who know what they're doing, so that that the business side can continue to operate effectively, so that the revenue can continue to be generated, so that the station can continue to be a leader.
How indebted we are to the good work you did back in the 80s and in securing us a permanent full-time license and getting us transferred to an FM frequency and moving the transmitter around. Seriously, I don't think, you know, now in 2009 BFM would be where it is if all of that hard work hadn't happened. So
bless you, thank you for that. Also, you know, to Debbie Gibbs, to Lisa Vanderati, and everybody else who was working with us at the same time, Robert Southern, we were just kind of a team of mad people who didn't know when to stop. Okay, this is reminiscent to me of James Charlton, his love for Thelonious Monk and for Miles Davis and the weekly show he used to do, but also how B was able, music-wise, to divert into those specialist areas, those specialist shows, and always, I'll use the word again, to beat leaders in music coverage.